piece of work I made, and it was from a diary I'd kept in 1981, the year of the hunger strikes. I would say something like, went to the cinema with Sammy tonight to see Scanners. And then the next line, the Pope was shot and he's in hospital, or...
The milkman, seriously injured in rioting in the city last Tuesday, died today.
Below the age of 30 to 35, there's no first-hand experience of the Troubles. People don't know or don't remember.
Tens of thousands of people have attended the funeral in Belfast of hunger striker Bobby Sands.
On the night that Bobby Sands had been buried, the diary talks about me taking apart a Rubik's Cube to impress some girls. School got closed that day. Belfast was at a standstill. There were riots, people out in the streets with bin lids, and I was at a youth club with my friends trying to, you know, impress girls. You know, even in the worst places, people will try to survive through doing normal things.
The corner of the building seemed to cave in towards us. Quite a lot of people were very badly injured.
If you were going to a pub or a club, you actually had to go through a cage that they monitored who you were before you actually got inside, in case you were a terrorist and you were going in to spray the place with bullets.
The bomb was somewhere in the area of the cash.
Or plant a bomb.
If we could have a drone and look down on it, you'd see that the intercourse between the two areas is restricted in all sorts of ways. Once we're through this next set of gates, we're in the Shankill, and we're in the Unionist area.
Every window was smashed, every table was overturned, and every light, everything went out.
75 to 79, 80, pretty much the worst years of the Troubles.
Was there any warning at all? No warning whatsoever.
And yet, if you'd have spoke to me then, I was a very happy teenager, I loved punk music, I was into all of that. I think I lived a very ordinary life. It's the leaving that makes you reflect back and think there was nothing ordinary about it at all.
I'm Christine Leach, and this is the final episode of Ireland Portrayed, a series that has explored how ideas of Ireland and Irish identity have been visually represented, and how art has told that story. Today I'm in Belfast to consider the cost of identity as it violently played out here in Northern Ireland, and to explore some of the art and artists that expose the human drama and consequences of this conflicted state.
In August 1969, when this area was burnt out by loyalists, the British Army came in the next day and led barbed wire along the interface between the two areas.
This is retired Professor of Sociology, Bill Rolston.
All these years later, you now have a 9 metre high wall and the mesh is post-ceasefire. Then, when you get round a few corners, you get 800 metre long, 9 metre high wall. That's our biggest, grandest peace wall. We've more walls since the peace agreement than there were before. But it's the thing I said earlier about fear.
Yeah.
Fear is real.
Bill is bringing me on a personal tour of some of the Belfast murals, a key form in Northern Ireland's visual story. When news of the Troubles appeared in print or were broadcast to TV screens around the world, it was often these divisive images that came to visually represent the complex politics of identity and the history of violent conflict here.
Can we cross over without getting killed?
In 1981, Bill began photographing political murals across the north as a hobby.
And I haven't stopped since, and I really love political murals, mostly because I'm amazed at the ability of these people, who are almost all self-taught artists. We're at the Lower Falls Road, part of West Belfast, the inner city West Belfast here, Christine, and we're at the corner of Divis Street and Northumberland Street at what's called the International Wall.
So you can see the international themes coming through in these ones. So when did the mural painting start here, the connection with the international campaigns? What are the origins of that?
Well, it's quite simple to explain on the Republican side where we are now. It's a question of them looking around the world and saying, who's like us? Who do we identify with? And it's places where they're experiencing wars of colonization, repression, socialism. So you've got, as I say, Kurdistan, Cuba, Sri Lanka, South Africa. This is a very well viewed wall. So if you want to get a message out, this is the wall to put it on. We've still to go to the loyalist side, where it's a different story. You've got some Sikh soldiers from the First World War, some African soldiers. So it's about empire.
Mm.
It's about war and empire. That's the overwhelming sense that you get of so many murals, especially in the Shankill area now. Everything is duplicated in this society. Everything. Private shops, bus routes, churches, sporting facilities.
So it's like a mirror on either side.
Which means you'd never have to cross the line.
Yes.
So these, on the other side, it's a double set of gates.
Yep.
These are locked 6:45, 7 o'clock at night, and then open the next morning.
The murals didn't stop with the fractious peace secured by the Belfast Good Friday Agreement 20 years ago. Just as more peace walls were built post-ceasefire, muralists co-opted these interface structures as canvas. Belfast remains a city of borders, and for many, the murals were and remain signposts of segregation.
What about the idea of these murals and the fact of these murals and this art as a type of territorial marker?
In one sense, in a descriptive sense, yes, they are territorial markers. We're in the heart of Republican West Belfast. No loyalist would want to paint a mural here or could get away with painting a mural here. And it would work when we walk a few hundred yards and cross over into the Shankill, right? So it's territorial in that way. The reason I don't like the notion of territorial markers is the argument that says that these are like gang graffiti on the edges of areas, keeping people out or saying, you know, this is our territory. These are not on the edges of areas. These are in the heart of territory. That's what they're about. They're about mobilizing the community so they're in the heart of the community. They're about pride. They're about memory. The murals are about commemoration. They're about, we struggled, we got this far. We know where we're at. We're not turning back. We're moving forward. So we're just skirting the edge of the centre of town here.
The first mural appeared here in Belfast in 1908 in the Protestant Loyalist community as part of annual celebrations of Unionist culture.
Second next street. There's himself.
Here, one figure, one symbol, turns up again in our visual story.
Okay, we're here in Donegal Pass, and we're standing looking at a King Billy mural, a very traditionally painted mural. The first one was painted by a guy called John McLean, shipyard worker. We know that. We know also it depicted King Billy on his horse at the Battle of the Boyne, and grew that actually out of the tradition of Loyalist banners. Right through from 1908 for the next 60, 65 years, that's what murals look like in this part of the world. Endless depictions of King Billy, White Horse, Battle of the Boyne, because they were painted or repainted each year as part of the celebrations of the Battle of the Boyne, the 12th of July.
Is a 17th century king a relevant figure still today?
Less so. Between 1908 and 1965, he was painted with this incredible ritualistic regularity. And the point of that was that this was the one day of the year, if no other, that unionists got together and said, Billy gets painted each year because he's the overarching symbol to which we can all agree on this one day. Mm-hmm. Now, with civil rights, with the rise of the conflict, something happened to unionism. It split and has never reunited. So unionism split. They're not one big happy family anymore. There's no overarching symbol. So King Billy does not have the same significance.
Someone puts on a uniform, be it a police uniform, an orange order banner, they assume the identity of that organisation. And it was the organisation, that institution, that has always fascinated me, and the kind of power that it plays within society here.
Paul Seawright is an art photographer of exceptional talent. Born in Belfast, his work is internationally celebrated.
Those things kind of moved around as I was growing up at the periphery of your life, parades and the Orange Order and policing and security and the military. In fact, the Orange Order work, I kind of stumbled into making that work.
It was his work here in Belfast in 1988, an extraordinary series called Sectarian Murders, that first catapulted Seawright into the limelight. 3 years later, he created his Orange Order series. In one image, a hand wearing a fingerless leather glove grips a side drum tightly. We see tattoos on the forearm. Other marching figures are visible against a cold background of steel railings, and on the face of the drum, in orange and black, the words Young Citizen dominates the frame. The hard light finds an unconcealed defiance in the image, yet the low angle suggests a child's view.
It's a very dark exhibition, very black, very oppressive.
I'm here at the University of Ulster, where Paul is Professor of Photography and Dean of Visual Arts.
But there's some, the odd image in there that shouldn't ever have got to that final edit, which were from the very beginning of the project, which were quite celebratory, you know, blue skies and colourful banners and almost comedic. But you've got to remember that that would have been my experience of those parades and of the Orange Order. It was not a negative experience growing up. It was a family experience. My father would have taken us to the bonfires on the 11th night, and, you know, we would have helped build them on the 11th night as we got older. We would have went as a family to the same spot at the BBC to watch the parades on the 12th of July every year. It was a happy time. It was a family moment. It was summer. It was sunny. And that's where I started. But then, of course, I had never got close to the Orange Order. I mean, I'd never really thought up until the point of spending that year photographing them what it really meant to be an organisation that opposed another section of the community and what it really represented. Of course, you know that and you understand it, but not understand it deeply in terms of what that perspective could mean. And the work literally, and to say metaphorically, got darker and darker as I spent more and more time with them. And I become more and more kind of disturbed about any relationship I would or wouldn't have had with the Orange Order. So again, the focus was very much upon young people. There's a lot of photographs of young people. The photographs are made from a perspective of a child. They're quite low down, again, you know, maybe waist level, that kind of looking up. There's an image, which very important one in that series, of a man holding a child with just their feet, you can see, but it's clearly a child, you know, and you're thinking about how those traditions are passed on and generations after generation.
So you have a very clear idea of what you want to say, and you're looking for images that will help tell that story.
Absolutely. I mean, so, and I was looking for situations to be able to conjure that idea of negativity and challenge and generational negativity. And I think that's important to say, because I kind of work, I mean, you're constructing meaning. That's it, really. And I think it's a very active process where I am constructing images to say something. And that narrative is something that's very personally mine, and I own up to that. There's, it's not trying to be neutral. It's very much my interpretation of that idea and my kind of working out of that idea in a photograph.
Paul left Belfast to study at the West Surrey College of Art and Design in England.
Was it a culture shock to be in England?
Honestly, you couldn't describe how much of a culture shock it was. It was really extraordinary. Can you imagine part of the same country, in inverted commas? The culture will be quite similar, if not identical. Wow, it was like a real bolt out of the blue for me from day one. Just everything from, you know, obviously the environment, not being searched, going into shops, and no security, no violence. Actually, it was such a sleepy Surrey town that in fact I thought I'd made a mistake going there. I mean, it was so safe and so benign that I thought, actually, I'm like a fish out of water here. It's not going to suit me. If I was going to use my art for anything interesting, it would be that. It would be to reflect on that experience, that otherness.
We're not
going
start
there,
down
though.
Here.
Yeah.
Actually, we start maybe here. I formed a company called Thaw, which was all about the whole idea of kind of the thawing of injuries and hatreds and bigotries. So I continued making products. There was a whole series of tinned products, like Baby's Billy carrots. Like King Billy actually brought the carrot from Holland to Ireland. Mm-hmm. You kind of think, now that's the main ingredient in Irish stew.
Yeah.
That surely scores some points in terms of Irish identity.
Renowned for her feminist work on the Northern Ireland conflict and Irish history, artist Rita Duffy deploys a razor wit to sunder our conventional narratives.
Here is the Bruna Boyne tea bags.
She's guiding me through her souvenir shop, an exhibition first commissioned by the Arts Council as part of the 1916 centenary commemorations in Dublin and now showing in Belfast. Here, Rita takes everyday domestic things and reimagines them as provocative artworks that question legacy, cultural divisions, and identity.
I actually collect images of King Billy. Mostly they've got, like, lots of the King Billy images will have a man kind of half in the water, half out with the horse, just about ready to stamp on him. And that was your position in this picture. I couldn't be part of it. You know, gathering wood for the bonfire wasn't on our radar as Catholics living in a predominantly Protestant area. I mean, we literally got into the car on the 10th of July, and so did any other Catholic in Northern Ireland who could afford to get up and leave. The bopper hoppers were things that we played with as children in the 70s in Belfast. Obviously, they're orange kind of rubber bouncing balls, and I kind of reinvented them as things that you might hop across the boyne on. Right, so to reinvent it, you know, a gallant king with ribbons and lace, a kind of an erect sword, and when you have the two of them together, the other one is a well-dressed orange man, and it's as if he's on his bopper hopper. And of course, in the middle, I had to throw in the jar of Padraig Pearse's pasta sauce. I thought about Ireland and the whole kind of the identity of Ireland, the politics in Ireland in terms of nationalism. The text on the jar of pasta sauce is a reinvention or a reworking of his famous Gormanstown speech. Because what he was advocating, I've seen for myself, and the results of it look very much like pasta sauce spilt on the street. So there's a humour, but there's a layer where that goes down to a deep realisation of the rhetoric that these men proclaimed. I started to use...
Rita's work is very often autobiographical, and she pursues these vast themes of politics and identity in a way that is both intimate and personal.
Was making art about the conflict and about the North a choice for you?
I wasn't making art about the conflict. I was making art that was about how I was trying to rationalise, survive, navigate. I mean, I was a home delivery in Stramulis, which is a Protestant working class aspiring kind of district on the edge of the university. I'd gone to school in the Markets area of Belfast, which was a real kind of rough experience. And then I went to school on the Falls Road in St Dominic's through the 70s. And we travelled from a relatively quiet university area, two buses across town into what was a war zone. There was a girl in my class, her father was a Catholic judge, one of the very few Catholic judges. Being a Catholic and supporting the system, that was the worst you could do. And they shot him outside the school one morning when he was leaving his two daughters to school. And in the same classroom, I had a friend whose brother was sentenced to 25 years in prison for blowing up a garage. So there, in one classroom, was the entire conflict. And there I was, as a 13, 14, 15-year-old, figuring it all out.
Rita Duffy's early work is full of lines, walls, fear, black space, and as she herself has described, minds that are semi-detached. For her, Belfast is one community divided. And no visual portrays this idea as potently for me as her 1989 painting, Segregation.
So you have this kind of dark void with two hands kind of pushing women and children to either side of the painting. At the top, there are kind of two older figures. And all of that work was exaggerated. And, you know, I was looking at Otto Dix and George Grosz, who had been painting in Germany between the wars. And I really loved that social comment, that kind of satire. You place the composition such that there's a balance, but it's this void that is maybe a dark satan of a priest, or it's obviously a kind of a traditional crevice that keeps people apart.
Segregation is not hanging in Belfast. It's in the permanent collection of the Crawford Art Gallery in Cork, where I've come to see it with assistant curator Michael Waldron.
It's a really, in some ways, deliberately grotesque picture. Ranks of people who have been divided by large hands that seem to be coming from nowhere, pulling people apart, so very much segregating people into communities or into binaries, to oppositions. And it really very much employs Rita Duffy's magic realist style, in that it takes the everyday and then adds something almost so troubling and beyond belief that it couldn't really exist.
And it's very physical, isn't it? One of the fingers from the hands that emerge from the centre is sticking into a woman's eye.
Yeah, it's very gestural in that sense. We're not meant to like this scene. We're meant to be repulsed by what is going on. And it is repulsive. And it seems that the figures themselves, the lower down on the canvas, are younger, invariably. They're children, and they're waving across the divide at each other. So there is a sense of a social construction here. Men are at the top of this hierarchy, and even the women at the center who are being really pulled apart, it seems that there is regret in some of the expressions. This isn't hatred, it's sort of a mistrust, but a regret as well. And it's the male figures at the top who seem to be aggressive, entrenched.
So what's Rita Duffy trying to say with this painting?
I think it's to do with maybe the atmosphere of 1989. You know, it's less than a decade off the what would become the Good Friday Agreement. Maybe there's an appetite here for society actually to mend, but perhaps the hope is with these children, but it needs nurturing.
Yeah.
And as an artist from Belfast, she grew up and I suppose started making work in the 80s in response to a lack of that storytelling, because there is very much a narrative in this body of work from this period. And she didn't see this work in the Ulster Museum or, you know, any of the other institutions that were essentially tasked with telling the story of the people. And so this is a response to that void.
Black flags are flying from houses and lampposts along streets throughout West Belfast and Twinbrook. Crowds of people had been making their way up the Falls and Andersonstown roads towards Twinbrook all morning.
On the 5th of May 1981, Bobby Sands died after 66 days on hunger strike in the May's Longkesh prison. Sands' shock election to the British Parliament while on hunger strike had triggered an international media vigil, with hundreds of reporters descending on Belfast to cover the story.
Tens of thousands of people have attended the funeral in Belfast of hunger striker Bobby Sands. The Northern Ireland Secretary has repeated that the British government will not give in to the demands.
For Margaret Thatcher's government, the IRA hunger strikes were the publicity campaign of convicted criminals. For Republicans, they were legitimate protest in support of their call for the reinstatement of political prisoner status.
We're coming up a little bit further up the Falls Road, a little bit deeper into West Belfast, and there's a...
But where public space was previously presumed unionist, in the wake of Bobby Sands' death, nationalist murals began to appear all over the city.
Yeah, so where are we coming up to now, Bill?
We're coming up to the Sinn Féin offices in West Belfast. And on the side of the Sinn Féin offices, huge big mural of Bobby Sands.
Go and have a look?
Yes, let's do it.
It is really colourful, isn't it? It's rainbow-hued. Yeah.
Well, the main thing about it is the central huge portrait of Bobby Sands. Long hair, smiling. It's based on the photograph that, if you're old enough to remember, 1981 was the main photograph. In fact, it was the only photograph at the time that the media had of Bobby Sands. There's a story told in a book about a meeting of BBC news bosses complaining that they wanted another photograph but couldn't get one because this one made him look too nice.
What's that? The symbol at the top.
He's the central
Phoenix
character,
yeah.
And it's got quotations from him. It's got the broken chains, which is not just about imprisonment, but also about, you know, the chains of colonialism. And the top symbol is the bird, the phoenix, the bird that rises from its own ashes, which has been a standard symbol for the provisionals since they started in December 1969. It's flanked by two other smaller portraits, one of Kieran Doherty and the other of Joe McDonnell. So together they're the three Belfast hunger strikers who died in 1981. The other seven were from outside Belfast, all IRA men. You'll frequently meet people going in and out of this building, the Sinn Féin offices, who were in jail with Bobby Sands. So it's not just a historical figure where it might be to a younger person.
So as a method of communication and being able to paint on walls and tell a visual story, how significant was that?
In the north, the broadcasting ban, what was it, 86 to 94? In the south, you had a different trajectory. So the murals predate the broadcasting ban. The murals really took off on the Republican side during the hunger strike before Bobby Sands died, so the spring of 1981. But if you ask the original muralists, they'll tell you that one reason they took to mural painting was to break censorship, because they couldn't get their story told on the airwaves, and this was the way to do it.
So there was a sense that this is a canvas we can take ownership of, and yeah, it's public as well.
It's public, and it's very, very effective. If you look right through the 1980s, you'd be hard-pressed to have seen some international correspondent doing a report from Belfast who wasn't posed in front of a mural.
And I think one of the frustrations for me was that the conversations I had with people about Belfast and Northern Ireland, I mean, they read it in a very simplistic way. I mean, you know, and the complexities of it just lost on them. Not surprising, the kind of reductive nature of the press and media telling of the Northern Irish story in those days, I think, is such that people only really saw it as a very binary issue. And I guess that's something I thought that I had to try and address in the work. And I think if you look at all of the work I've done around conflict, the ordinary is important, because when you deal with the extraordinary, it stops people in their tracks and they don't ever get past that. The sectarian murder work took its cue from that, trying to make landscapes that were not particularly spectacular. The violence itself is not in the frame.
Sectarian Murders 1988 established Paul Seawright's reputation as an artist. Paul photographed a series of the murder sites of innocent civilians who had been killed in the 1970s for being Protestant or Catholic. But he removed all reference to the victims' religion in the accompanying text. On these large-scale images, he redirected the reductive lens of the media's camera to tell a more complete story.
So this one is Saturday, the 9th of June, 1973. Do you want to read for us what the text is that goes with it?
Sure. It says, a 60-year-old man was found shot 3 times in the head in Ballysillan playground. The area showed signs of a struggle. I grew up in Ballysillan, so this is the local park. This is a park we'd have went to as children. It's a park that I got beat up in as a 16-year-old punk going through this place. So that's important. These landscapes are not just landscapes of conflict. They're my landscapes. I mean, they belong to me. I mean, this is my home. These are the landscapes I inhabited and still inhabit now, I guess.
This image is an image clearly of a playground, and what you see when you walk up to it are the primary colours of the merry-go-round, and with a man and a child on the swing. And then it's the text that adds that extra edge and puts a completely different slant on the image.
I'd read this article by an Austrian chemist at the turn of the 19th century. He suggested that he had found an image of a window on the eye, on the retina of a dead cow. And he believed that, well, he espoused this theory that the very last thing that we saw when we died is imprinted on our retina. I mean, it wasn't true, clearly. But that idea was wonderful, and I kind of thought, look, there's something in that. And so partly that was what got me to kind of make these images low to the ground, to evoke that idea, but also to give it some kind of forensic feel. So they've got these kind of harsh, cold flash in daylight. And yet then I deliberately make that out of focus in the foreground, which is the antithesis of what a forensic photographer would do. So I'm just playing with some of those ideas. And obviously colour, as you say, colour is really important, because again, in Northern Ireland, colour is everything. Colour is territory. And that everything actually in an image of Belfast at that time is potentially emblematic of something.
This art focuses our attention on the lost lives and the ordinary urban and suburban landscapes they once occupied, places where identity somehow justifies killing, where violence is exposed.
I'm trying to deal with images and situations that people just don't want to deal with. And if you can do that through art practice, I think you've really done something, because people in the late 1980s had enough. You know, compassion fatigue, as John Taylor called it, I think, at that time, that, you know, the narrative had been so repeated and so played out that it was very difficult to shock anybody anymore. And you just then look at, you just pick a random year or a random 6 months and you look at a list of the people killed in a month or 2 months in 88, 89. It's phenomenal. It's really, it's startling. I mean, if it was happening now, I think, given the gap we've had, I mean, I just think people would be outraged, but we had got so used to it. It was so routine. It rarely made the national news. Nobody was really interested. And I think, although I admit that the audience that you reach through art practice and these things would be obviously a small audience, it's important nonetheless that there was another way to come at looking at this.
How do they sit now in the context of 2019?
There's certainly an appetite to look back at this period of the conflict, but to do it through art practice, because I think it's a softer and easier and less contested medium than journalism would be. Art practice and photography within art practice has to give up its meaning more slowly. That's important. And that's what also gives us its longevity. This work has started to appear in those kind of Troubles art exhibitions and so on, and been purchased by museums for that purpose. And actually, I've been really encouraged by the kind of responses to it, because I think a whole new generation of people, I think, are beginning to question what went on during that time.
Below the age of 30 to 35, there's no first-hand experience of the Troubles. This is the sort of main entrance into our new The Troubles and Beyond gallery.
Kim Mawinney is Senior Curator of Art at National Museums Northern Ireland, and we're here at the Ulster Museum.
And this particular part of the gallery is a dustbin lid. And a dustbin lid was used by communities to alert the people in the streets that there was maybe a raid going on with the security forces. And more often women would go out onto the street and bash the metal bin lids on the ground. And this was also used during the hunger strikes as a protest against what was happening. It was also used in an artwork, which is an incredible artwork by Lockie Morris, where he had used a series of bin lids across a line, and he had actually used tar tire tracks across them, and it looked like little people. And these tire tracks were resonant of the sort of army vehicles. You're just standing beside a wonderful photograph by Donovan Wiley. Donovan was very interested in the security infrastructure. And when you think of people coming to Northern Ireland with tourists, they just haven't any idea of how we lived, and the fact that people were constantly being monitored, constantly being watched. And this is Watchtower, from his Watchtower series. The British Army put these military structures, monitoring structures, up across the border. This infrastructure since 1998 has actually been dismantled. So it's really important for us to collect this type of artwork too, because it is so reminiscent of that time that the public will forget in many respects.
There's such a contrast in this image between the greenness and the nature, and it's a landscape image, and then there's this really sinister structure at the very top of the hill.
Yeah, this is actually one of the more landscape-orientated pieces. Nobody really gets close up to these, and to have the visual, you know, it goes back to ancient Ireland in that way, sort of hill fort. There's that connection as well that he's making just with the composition of the actual photograph and how he's done that.
It's like their defence positions, their surveillance positions. If you went back now to look at that hill now, it's been dismantled, so what would you see? What would be there?
It would just be a normal mountain again. Yeah, exactly. And like, I remember as a child going down through the border and all the mechanics of what you had to go through, and you knew you were being watched because there was all this military architecture. But that was only me going to Dublin. Think of all the people who actually had to do that, like farmers, etc., that were doing it backwards and forwards on a daily basis. You know, that's really imposing on your life.
Walking through this space with Kim and understanding how it was curated, there is a tension and a palpable urgency to this memory keeping.
We need to allow them to see what life was like. For instance, Security Barrier by Rita Duffy allows us to see how there was this ring of steel around the centre of Belfast. And people can't, you know, comprehend the fact that, you know, there was no life in the centre of the city. Everything closed down. You couldn't go out of the city without going through a metal turnstile. You weren't allowed back into the city. And it was during the day, there were searchers. And that's what Rita portrays in that painting, is the fact that you had to walk through these security barriers. You were physically checked. Your bag was checked, whether they were with metal detectors or not. So it was a really imposing way to have to go in to just do your Saturday shopping.
On Saturday, the 4th of March, 1972, two friends, Anne Owens and Janet Breen, went shopping in Belfast. That afternoon, they stopped for a coffee in the crowded Abercorn restaurant. By 4:30, they were dead, killed outright when a bomb planted in the restaurant exploded next to them.
Early reports indicate that the bomb was somewhere in the area of the cash desk in the restaurant.
The bomb went off. I was standing at the bar and the corner of the building seemed to cave in towards us. A lot of people seemed to be very badly injured.
But the whole floor just lifted, the whole club lifted right up, and the place filled with smoke immediately. Every window was smashed, every table was overturned, and every light, everything went out. You know?
Was there any warning at all?
No warning whatsoever.
According to eyewitnesses,
believed to be an IRA attack, no one claimed responsibility.
The injured and dead were put into a fleet of ambulances. There weren't enough of them to take all the injured, and police...
The force of the blast caused horrific, life-changing injuries to more than 130 other women and men at the Abercorn, and many had to have limbs amputated.
Effie McWilliam, who had been really an important sculptor who'd studied at the Slade, had been deeply affected when the Abercorn bombing went off in the centre of Belfast. And he wanted not only to show what a bomb blast could do to the human figure, which, you know, from a sculptor's point of view is an incredibly interesting dynamic on that figure. He also wanted it as a metaphor for women who were affected by violence. He made a large series of these smaller sculptures, Women of Belfast 7, but he also made three large-scale sculptures, one of which is in the F.E. McWilliam Gallery, and the other one that we actually own is in the Troubles Art exhibition that's currently on in Nerve Visual in Derry.
We're in the F.E. McWilliam Gallery in Banbridge. He was born in Banbridge and was a modernist sculptor who made his career in London. And
I've come to Banbridge to learn more about this work with art historian and curator of the gallery, Dr. Rian Coulter. One of the most iconic images that he produced was a series of works around the female figure in a bomb blast. Mm-hmm. So you have some of the plaster casts here.
We do, yeah. So he really didn't engage with politics, really, or even particularly Irish culture much. He had a couple of commissions until the 1970s. And he said, really, it was one particular incident. It was the Abercorn tea room bombing in 1972, where a lot of young women, a lot of young nurses, were killed and injured. And obviously, he was in London, and he'd still family in Northern Ireland, and he was watching the news, and he was seeing the newspapers, and he was really, really moved and troubled by this particular event. And so he did a series of figurative works called Women of Belfast or Women of Bomb Blast, and they really are literally figures being blown through space, and so their clothing, the drapery is very sort of dramatic. He did actually use, you know, sort of drawings of and pictures of ballerinas, because there is a really dance sort of balearic element to that. So there's a strange tension between the beauty of the form and the beauty of the sculptures and the horror of what he's depicting. His work was collected quite early by the Ulster Museum. So the large woman of Belfast, Woman in the Bomb Blast, is a really iconic work, I think, for artists and for the public in Northern Ireland, because it was always there. And when other artists weren't actually responding to the Troubles, or at least it wasn't being shown, this work was there. And so many people have come to me and said, I remember that. I remember that piece being in the Ulster Museum, being in show. And it was one of the few things that, you know, would actually engage with Troubles during the Troubles. So it was a really important piece.
Why do you think it was shown?
Well, he was a really, you know, he's a really well-known international sculptor, and he was from here, and I think they wanted to celebrate that. And also there is that strange sense where it is beautiful and it's traditional. you know, it doesn't really shock people in the same way, initially at least, until they begin to think about it. So I think it probably got away with it. Now, it wasn't shown in London in his Tate retrospective near the end of his life, and those works weren't shown in it. And now nobody's ever said that was because they were too political, especially when you put a lot of them together. It became a thing, and you know, to show those in London during when the Troubles were still going on was felt to be too, I think, too radical. Mm.
For an audience to interpret a piece, to have it speak to their experience, it must be seen. And commonly what is seen is what is collected or displayed by our public institutions and national galleries. Rita Duffy was one of the artists who responded to the Troubles, but it would take years before her work was collected or shown.
I had the strange experience of my painting tutor here in the School of Art asking me why people were wearing these black armbands, and I told him. Now, this was a man who'd lived in Belfast for 15 years, but after 15 years in Belfast, he was unaware that people were wearing armbands because the second hunger striker died. And I mean, I wasn't a paid-up Republican, but I remember thinking there's something strange about being somewhere as an artist and not knowing what's going on around you. And I remember watching the Co-op building across the street from here. It was clad in brown plastic squares, kind of 60s rendering. I remember after an incendiary bomb, watching that melting down onto the street and thinking, visually, this is, like, incredible. But, like, there was no big engagement. And apathy, general apathy. And I thought, to hell with this. What we're experiencing here is a microcosm of what's going on in other places in the world. Do it right, and this will provide me with the authentic material to kind of to work on.
How was it received? Was it easy to sell your work?
You know, some of it sold to, you know, the agents, like the Arts Council and various individuals bought work, but by and large, people weren't looking at that. So that work wasn't being made. You know, people were making paintings of still life and landscape within this context. And it was like, it was that headspace of like, let's pretend we're in Essex. And lots of people did that because it was a way of surviving. I suppose I've always had a debilitating curiosity. I've followed my nose. And yes, I was one of the first artists that addressed head on what was going on around us. It's interesting, a few years back, I sold the collection of black and white drawings from the 80s to the Imperial War Museum because they had nothing in the Imperial War Museum that reflected the female narrative. Mm. So it's, you know, it is kind of interesting. Sometimes you just got to wait. There is a bit of a scramble going on to kind of fill the gaps, but that's primarily because the Ulster Museum did not and could not and would not touch anything political with a 40-foot pole. And even now, there's difficulty in addressing the reality of what we've lived through. And that's before we even mention the issue of memory, truth, justice, collaboration, collusion. I mean, it's starting. They can't stop this hemorrhaging. It's starting to come out. And it will continue to come out, and hopefully we'll be flushed free of it, because you can't keep that type of narrative hidden. You can't ignore it. Well, you can ignore it, but not forever.
The Ulster Museum staged its first retrospective of Troubles-related art in 2014. It followed decades of occasional censorship, then caution, and an unsatisfactory first attempt at a gallery dedicated to the Troubles in 2009. The retrospective included pieces from Wolverhampton's large Northern Ireland collection and the Arts Council of Northern Ireland's significant collection, which had been gifted to the Ulster Museum 2 years earlier.
So I'll bring you back to the origins of that exhibition. So it opened in 2014 and it took 5 years to put together. Why do you think it hadn't happened before then?
It was very difficult for people to reflect on that time. It was still very close, and it wasn't really until we started researching the exhibition that we realised that art was actually going to be a tool with which we could actually help people. To be honest, we really didn't know what the public's reaction would be until they came through the door. And anything with Troubles, you know, in its title, automatically brings in sections of the public that wouldn't necessarily come to an art gallery or a museum. But because it was Troubles, they wanted to make sure that it was portraying their troubles. And sometimes people would say, well, this is obviously curated by a loyalist, or this is curated by a nationalist perspective. And it was sort of like 50-50, which meant that obviously we were doing something right. We hadn't had a shock, you know, bias in any shape or form.
With Bill Rolston, I wanted to talk about that idea of separate narratives and the visual symbols and motifs that repeat these stories and versions of the stories in the very public conversation of the murals. The Red Hand of Ulster is one such symbol with many variants to its origin. Most tell some version of how rival chiefs raced by boat to conquer Ireland with the promise that whoever touched land first could claim it. As they rowed towards land, the losing chief took a sword, cut off his hand and threw it onto the shore, thereby touching Ulster first.
By the Middle Ages, it was the symbol of the O'Neills. And how it became a joint symbol is this, that in the Reformation, some of the O'Neills converted to Protestantism and they took the symbol with them. So that, for example, you could have later a Terence O'Neill in 1969, a Prime Minister of the North, who was a Protestant.
So should it not be a unifying symbol as opposed to a divisive symbol?
No, because we're not talking about the same place. I mean, literally we're not talking about the same place, because that's talking about a six-county Ulster, and the other one that we saw down on the Republican side is talking about a nine-county Ulster.
In a place wary of every detail, visuals have magnified power. And these contested symbols also admit the anxiety inherent in searching for identity in the past.
No, the point of it is that I think every group needs to have the sense that it's, you know, A, that it's been there from time immemorial, and B, that what it's doing now is right because it's what it's been doing all along. And both those things you can get from those myths, you know.
He was driving a Ford Sierra car and was approaching traffic lights at the junction of North Road and Newton Arts Road.
Maybe we should stop here. So this is where it happened, actually, the bomb went off here, right here.
The victim had just left his home nearby when the bomb exploded around 2 o'clock.
1989, there was a ex-RUC man, a guy called Gabriel Mullally.
The device appears to have been planted under the vehicle, and the man died almost instantly. His car was...
So he would come out of the street over here, just past the nursery there? And turned up here, and the IRA had put a bomb under his car. I mean, he was a Catholic, but he was an ex-policeman, so they targeted him, and he got to the lights. He was four cars back, so I guess just a little bit further up than where we are here, when it exploded.
Paul Seawright again.
And actually, the car was blown right up in the air and right into the hedge over there. So we were living just down there, just the far side of that street he came out of, and... never forget the bang and the explosion.
So you heard that sound?
Heard that sound. You know, it was quite shocking even then. You know, you knew your windows rattling and the noise of it. So I would used to walk out here also to get my bus into work. I was teaching at the art college at that time in Belfast. This was all cordoned off then. And, you know, you could see the car and the trees. But when I came back after work and when I came out to look the next morning to get my bus the morning after, and there was kind of a damage to the hedge, and there was a small, like, scar on the road. The tarmac was just kind of scorched a little bit, and that was it. And then for months afterwards, I would watch it fade away and disappear, that little scar on the road and the hedge go back to normal. And it was literally a matter of months, and that idea of this, of the landscape repairing and returning to this surface banality is something that I think was really pertinent to me in carrying on to make landscapes that try to evoke that violence without showing it.
Yeah, so the obvious evidence disappeared and the city carried on.
I think that's it. And you know, when you reflect, that would have been the case with all of it. I mean, almost all of it. But in terms of people being killed and murdered, no matter how terrible those situations were, not just the landscape, the place repairs and moves on, but people do too.
Yeah.
And it annoyed me that the impact was so slight. It was so slight that something so enormous had happened so close to where we lived, and yet the impact was almost unreadable. The idea of landscape in Irish culture and Irish visual culture, I mean, is there anything more powerful than that? And in fact, if you look at the history of visual art in Ireland, what landscape has dealt with in terms of dealing with issues, it's enormous. There's almost no issue that landscape hasn't been able to deal with, from, you know, the horrors of the Catholic Church and abandoned babies to war and the famine. I mean, all kinds of things. And I think landscape has a wonderful potential to be able to expand ideas that would otherwise be invisible. And I guess it's dealing with history. And the only way to deal with history is through something as tangible in the present. And landscape ends up being that we turn to.
Landscape then becomes the scar tissue. It will absorb us all. It will forget us. And it will remember.
I've always wanted to somehow find a way to give form to two very strong opposing narratives, opposing histories that are told and retold within their own communities, and they are made more solid and they're confirmed by their own communities over time. And it's very difficult to do much about that. And the nature of our education, which is still effectively segregated, allows that to carry on. And it's probably the biggest travesty or the biggest challenge of the peace process.
Do you feel that it stops Northern Ireland moving forward?
Yeah, I think we're really stuck. But it's like, unless we have the courage to face into the stuff that needs to be done now, which is kind of looking at memory, looking at events, looking at a recollection of the truth, or coming as close as possible to that truth, we're not going to do anything other than go round another loop.
This is a debate that's going on constantly in the city. I'm involved with a number of consultations about how we tell the story of those years. Explain to me who were the good guys and who were the bad guys, and that, you know, that's not possible. I mean, you'd speak to lots of people who think that is possible, of course, but that's exactly the point. And I think artists never got themselves drawn into that too much. I mean, they were dealing with the impact of the violence on people and on communities. You know, two-thirds were civilians with no skin in the game in terms of the politics. I think the only way it will be possible will be to do it through art, because of the bleak way they deal with language and deal with history and narratives. We're still not at this point where we're ready to look at those situations and look at what happened over that time with an honesty that will be useful in helping us construct a future. Actually, the representation of it, both good and bad, you know, from the extreme of the photojournalist, simplistic, reductive stuff, right through to the most sophisticated art practice, we need all of it. And we need to put it all together, and I think it's the whole that will help us understand the past.
We saw the Art of the Troubles as a starting point, and this journey, to me, will never conclude. We have to continue this conversation with our public, and there will be lots of other aspects of the Troubles that will come out. I bought a piece by Ursula Burke last year for the collection, and it doesn't look directly related to the Troubles as such, but it is a beautiful porcelain bust of a woman. But then you realise that one of the eyes is bulging and it's bruised and it's damaged. She's, you know, part of domestic violence. The violence did not stop after the Good Friday Agreement or the Belfast Agreement. It continues in various different guises, and that legacy is who we need to continue to work with.
In Northern Ireland, the present holds a legacy of deep trauma that is recklessly trifled with by political or cultural amnesia. With Brexit, landscape is being called upon once again to expand our ideas of identity. And if the landscape changes between both parts of this island once again, how will that story be visually portrayed? As peace is practiced daily here in Northern Ireland, a generation is discovering the limits on language to articulate their present. Recognising the limitations of identity on this island is perhaps what its visual art identifies best.
Art maybe is some sort of way of helping us evolve as a species. And hopefully it'll be powerful enough to stop us destroying ourselves.
Ireland Portrayed was presented by Christine Leach. The series was written and produced by Mary Brophy with editing by Neil Boyle. It is an IWR media production for RTE Lyric FM. That was the fourth and final episode in the series, and the entire series covering 300 years of Irish art is available to podcast from RTE Podcasts and other platforms. Search for the Lyric Feature Podcast. For more information on the series and for some guided animations of the works featured in the programmes, see the RTE Culture page of the RTE website. We welcome your comments by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.